more of the black and red kernels and let them run into the box again through his fingers. He played with them, and as he played, merciful forgetfulness moved in upon him, and there was a new peace in his heart. This also had come from the expedition eastward. In the corn was life and the future. Looking up, he saw Joey, ever the curious one, gazing at him from across the room with interest. He felt himself warm toward Joey and called to him to come and see. Joey was interested, as always. Ish explained to him about the corn. During the passage of the years, their own community had delayed so long in trying to raise corn that in the end, he had not been able to find any still living seed. Now there was another chance. Then, even though it seemed a terrible thing to do, Ish took the little box and went out into the kitchen with Joey. They lighted a burner in the gasoline stove and took a frying pan. Carefully, allowing themselves only 2 dozen kernels, they poured some corn into the frying pan and parched the kernels over the flame. Even though they thus wasted some of the seeds, Ish felt too much moved emotionally to resist the temptation, and he justified himself by thinking that the actual demonstration to Joey immediately was necessary. The corn did not parch well and was barely edible. Neither of them cared for it much. Actually, Ish could only remember having eaten parched corn as a sophisticated cocktail relish. But he explained to Joey that parched corn had been a regular food on the American frontier, and that his ancestors must often have depended largely upon it. The big eyes, bright in the thin little face, showed that Joey appreciated the story. I wish, thought Ish, that he might grow stronger and be something firmer to count on. Well, I have wasted 2 dozen of them, but perhaps in Joey's mind, I have planted a more important seed. Wheat and corn. They too, like dog and horse, marched and shared with man, friends and helpers on the long way. Far in some dry corner of the old world, the little spiked grass sprouted more thickly around the edges of the campsites, where the disturbing and enrichment of the soil gave it ground to its liking. So first, perhaps, it adopted man, but soon man adopted it. The more it repaid his care, the more he coddled it. With his fostering, it grew taller and stronger, yielding more seed. But also it came to demand the tilled soil and the seedbed, free of the competition of the wilder grasses. The first year after there were no more plowed fields, the volunteer wheat sprang up on thousands of acres. But soon, there was less of it, and then still less. Like wolves upon the sheep, the fierce native grasses returned. They formed tough sod. Year after year, they grew from the same roots, thriving the better for lack of cultivation. After a while, there was no more wheat, except that far off in the dry lands of Asia and Africa, here and there, the little spiked grass still was growing, as it had grown before an incident called agriculture. So also with the maize. From the tropics of America, it too journeyed far with man. Like the sheep, it traded its freedom for a fat and pampered life. It could no longer even shed its own seeds, held tight within the tough husk. Even sooner than the wheat, the maize vanished. Only on the Mexican highlands, in thick clumps, the wild teosinte still pushed up tasseled tops against the high sun. So it will go, unless here and there a few men still linger. For if man cannot prosper without the wheat and the corn, still less can they prosper without man. Although George and Maureen kept track of the months and the days of the months, or thought they did, all the rest went more by the position of the sun and the state of the vegetation. Ish took pride in being able to estimate the time of the year, and when he compared notes with George's calendar, he was generally pleased to see that he was not more than a week or so wrong. If indeed he might not be right and George wrong, for Ish had no strong faith in George's accuracy. In any case, a week or two made no difference when it came to planting the corn. Obviously, the season was too far advanced. The cold weather would arrive before the corn was more than well sprouted. Next year, they would try it. In the next few days, however, Ish spent some time scouting about in the vicinity, trying to locate a good spot for the corn patch. He took Joey along with him, and the two were soon talking learnedly about exposures, soil, and possibilities for keeping the wild cattle out. Actually, Ish realized, their particular region was about the worst place in the United States for corn growing. A variety which was adapted to the dry and hot Rio Grande Valley might not even mature at all in the chilly and fog-blanketed summers near San Francisco Bay. Moreover, he himself was not a farmer, and had never even had a green thumb for gardening. His knowledge of plants and soils was mostly theoretical, gained from his studies in geography. He remembered how podzols and chernozems were formed, and he thought he might even recognize them when he saw them. But that did not make him a farmer. No one else in the tribe had been one either, although Maureen had grown up on a farm. This accident, so you might call it, that they had no one who was close to the soil, had already been of much importance in determining their communal outlook on life. One day, more than a week had passed, and the memory of Charlie and the oak tree had faded somewhat. Ish and Joey came back to the house after having located what seemed the most favorable sight they had yet seen. Em came out on the porch to meet them, and Ish knew immediately that something had happened. "What's the matter?" he asked quickly. "Oh, nothing much," she said. "I hope, anyway. Bob seems to be sick, a little." Ish stopped dead on the porch and looked at her. "No, I don't think so," she said. "I'm no doctor, and I don't think it's anything like that. I don't even see how it could be. Come and take a look at him. He says he's felt a little bad for the last few days." During the years, Ish had usually taken the responsibility of doctoring. He had developed some skill at treating cuts and bruises and sprains, and had once had a broken arm. But he had gained practically no experience with disease, because there were only the two that seemed to exist in the tribe. "Bob hasn't just got a case of that sore throat," he asked. "I can fix that soon enough."
"No," she said, as he had known she would. She would not be so obviously worrying about the sore throat. "No," she repeated. "He hasn't got a sore throat at all. He just seems laid out, flat."
"Sulfa will probably do the job anyway," said Ish cheerfully. "As long as there are thousands of pills in the drugstores and still good, we're lucky. And if sulfa won't work, I'll take a chance with penicillin." He went upstairs quickly. Bob was lying in bed, lying very still with his face turned away from the light.
"Oh, I'm all right," he said irritably. "Mother gets excited."
Proof enough to the contrary, thought Ish. Leon is taking the bed. A 16-year-old did not go to bed before he was too sick to stand. Ish looked around and saw Joey peering curiously at his brother.
"Joey, get out of here," he snapped.
"I'd like to see. I want to know about being sick."
"No, you keep your nose out of this. When you get bigger and stronger, I'll show you and teach you. But we don't want you getting sick, too. The first thing to learn about sickness is that it may go from one person to another."
Joey backed out reluctantly, his curiosity stronger than any theoretical fear of being sick. The tribe had had so little experience with the disease that the children had no respect for it. Bob complained of a headache and a general sense of unlocalized discomfort. He kept very still in bed, obviously prostrated. Ish took his temperature and found that just under 101, not too good or too bad. He prescribed 2 sulfa pills and a full glass of water. Bob gagged over the pills. He was not used to swallowing such things. Telling Bob to get some sleep, Ish went out and closed the door.
"What is it?"
Em asked him. He shrugged his shoulders.
Nothing that sulfa won't cure, I guess.
I don't like it, though. So soon.
Yes. There's such a thing, however, as coincidence, you remember.
I know that.
But you're the one that will be worrying. I'll give the pills every 4 hours, overnight at least, before I begin.
That's fine if it's so,
she said as the last word and went off. And Ish, before even he had got all the way downstairs, knew that her skepticism was justified. After all, why should a man not worry? In the old times, when you lived with all the protection of doctors and public health services, even then, the mysterious and sudden onset of disease was terrifying. How much more so now? Now, just as man lacked the all-embracing power of a nation around him, so also he felt himself bare and exposed and helpless for lack of that age-old tradition of medical skill. It's my fault, he thought. All these years of grace. I should have been studying the medical books. I should have made myself into a doctor. Yet the study of medicine had never appealed to him, even far back in the old times, when he had been thinking about a profession. And a man couldn't be a universal genius. Besides, there had been no pressure when nearly all the diseases seemed to have died out. That fact, when he thought of it, sometimes even made the great disasters seem beneficent. A magnificent wiping off of the slate which allowed man as a species to escape from most of the aches and pains he had been accumulating for so many centuries and start anew. Originally, each little isolated tribe must have developed and maintained its own special infections. If the evidence had been available, the anthropologists would probably have said that the Neanderthal men could be identified as well by their own special parasites as by their own special ways of chipping flint. In archaeology, when you found one culture just on top of another one, you assumed that Tribe B had wiped out Tribe A. So doubtless it had. But its weapons had probably been stronger parasites more often than longer spears. As he thought, he grew more alarmed. Although less than half an hour had passed, he went upstairs and looked in at Bob. Evening had come, and Bob lay quietly in the half-dark room. Ish did not want to disturb him, and so went downstairs again. He sat in a big chair and smoked. He would have liked to talk the matter over with someone, but Em did not have the background, and Joey was still too inexperienced. So he thought to himself. The tribe, they themselves, that is, had preserved measles and some kind of sore throat. Someone, he himself perhaps, had been the carrier, or else the germs were maintained by some animal with which they were in contact, the dogs or the cattle, or any one of 100 smaller ones. But the people in Los Angeles might be free of measles and have preserved mumps and whooping cough. And those in the Rio Grande would probably have kept dysentery. And now Charlie, even if he had not had those particular diseases of which he boasted, he might well have been a carrier of whatever happened to be prevalent around Los Angeles. That had not been such a fine idea, sending the boys off to explore. Suddenly Ish began to feel an unreasoning fear of any stranger. Give them 200 yards law, that was the idea, and then look at them over the sights of a good rifle. A fly buzzed in front of his nose, and the over-emphatic way he struck at it showed that his nerves were tense. Josie called for him to come in to dinner. Unlike the human lice, the housefly, not having irrevocably linked its destiny with man's, had suffered nothing that approached annihilation. Like the house rat, the house mouse, the human flea, and the cockroach, this other intimate household companion had suffered only a considerable reverse. Where formerly it had buzzed by hundreds and thousands, now it was reduced to its 20s or 10s. Nevertheless, it survived. For, like that lord whom Prince Hamlet calls a waterfly, the housefly also was secure in the possession of dirt. Though for it, dirt must mean not lands and estates,
but the word in its dysphemistic sense. As when the Bible of King James declares primly that Ehud struck King Eglon in the belly and the dirt came out. Thus, even though man should be reduced to the vanishing point or disappear altogether, the housefly was secure as long as the larger animals still lived and continued to leave droppings behind them. The eggs of the fly, thus deposited, soon hatched out, and the larvae found themselves embowered in rich and succulent food on which to feast, as snakes upon rats, woodpeckers upon grubs, and men on the flesh of dead animals. Still, with man eclipsed, times were hard. No longer did barnyards offer sights as rich as the ancient gift of the Nile. No longer was the countryside studded with beneficently unscreened privies. No longer did innumerable slums offer their choice piles of garbage and filth. Only here and there some few accumulations of nourishing excrement permitted the housefly to lay numerous eggs and breed up well-fostered larvae and send forth vigorous and busily traveling adults. A week later, the epidemic was in full course. Dick, Bob's companion on the expedition, had been the next to go down. But now Ezra and five of the children lay stricken. In proportion to its numbers, the community was in the grip of a devastating outbreak of what must be, Ish felt certain, typhoid fever. Some of the adults had been inoculated in the old times, but their immunity must long since have lapsed. All the children were totally unguarded. Even with all the old-time medical skill, typhoid had been combated chiefly by prevention. Once the disease was established, there was no remedy but to let it run its long and sinister course. Easy enough now, thought Ish, to do some second thinking. Easy enough, he thought bitterly, to know that Charlie, no matter what other diseases he might have had or thought he had, was really carrying the germs from an attack of typhoid fever. Perhaps he had been sick years before. Perhaps he had been sick recently. For quite possibly, the disease had made the passage in the area where he had lived. They would never know. And now, what did it matter? What they knew for certain was that Charlie, obviously unclean in personal habits, had eaten with the two boys for more than a week. In addition, the not too carefully constructed outhouses and the flies offered an obvious route of general infection. They began to boil all drinking water. They burned the old latrines and filled the old pits. They kept the new one so well sprayed with DDT that no fly could alight and live. All such precautions were obviously too late. Already, every individual must have been exposed to infection. Those who had not yet succumbed must either by good luck possess natural immunity, or the disease was still lying dormant in them, building up strength through its period of incubation. Day by day, one or more took to bed. Bob, now in his second week, lay tossing in delirium, a grim indication of the long road all the others must follow before they could grow better. Already those still on their feet were being worn down by the strain of nursing. They had scarcely time to give any thought to fear, and yet fear lay all around them, daily drawing its circle closer. There had been no deaths as yet, but neither had anyone passed the crisis of the fever. As in earlier years, each birth had seemed to force back the circle of darkness, so now with each newly stricken one, the darkness moved a step inward, bringing annihilation with it. Even if they did not all die in the epidemic, the loss of any large number might break, it seemed, the communal will to live. George and Maureen and Molly had taken to prayer, and some of the younger ones had joined with them. They were afraid that God was exacting retribution upon them for the death of Charlie. Ralph was just on the point of taking his family, as yet not stricken, and fleeing off somewhere. Ish dissuaded him, for the moment at least, arguing that any of them might already be infected, and that to be taken sick as a small and isolated group would be much more dangerous than to share with the whole community. We are close to panic, thought Ish. And then the next morning, he himself awoke, depressed, feverish, and half prostrated. He forced himself to his feet, made light of Em's inquiries, and avoided her glances. Bob was very bad and took most of Em's time. Ish tended Joey and Josie, who were both in the early stages. Walt, they had sent off to help in one of the other houses. In the afternoon, leaning over Joey's bed, Ish felt himself collapsing. With his last effort, he managed to get to his own bed and fall upon it. Hours later, it seemed, he came to himself. Em was looking down at him. She had managed to undress him and get him into bed. He looked up at her, feeling small. He gazed as a child might have gazed. Above all, fearing that he would see fear. If she was afraid, all was lost. But in her face, he saw no fear. The dark, wide-set eyes looked calmly at him. Oh, Mother of Nations. And then he slept. In his days and nights of delirium, he knew little of what happened. Through his fever, the great vague dream shapes moved in and pressed upon him from the dark outside. Horrible, inchoate as fog, not to be combated. Then sometimes he called out for someone to bring him his hammer, and he called the name of Joey sometimes. And again, worst of all, the name of Charlie. But also in his terrors, he called sometimes on the name of M. And then it might be that he awoke at the pressure of her hand and looked up. Always he looked for fear, but there was no fear. Then there was a week when he lay quieter, but so prostrated that at times his life seemed to him to be fluttering weakly to take flight and go, and he cared little. Only when he looked up and saw M, he felt courage and strength move out from her, and he held his lips hard together. For he thought life itself pressed close behind his lips, and that if he opened his mouth, it would escape like a butterfly. But as long as he looked up at M, he knew that he would have strength to hold that little faintly struggling thing within him. Only, when she had gone, he said to himself, now that he could think a little, she will break. Sometime she must break. She may not get the fever. We may hope for that good luck. But she cannot carry the burden for all of us. Now he realized more of what was happening. There had been deaths, he knew, but not who or how many. He dared not ask. Once he heard Jeannie come, wailing hysterically at the death of a child. Em said little, but strangely the spirit moved out from her, and Jeannie went away with courage to fight on. George came, unwashed and filth-smeared, a terror-stricken old man. Maureen had suffered a relapse, and their grandchild lay gasping. Em said nothing about God, but again a spirit went out from her, and George walked away with head high and saying the words, "Yea, though he slay me." Thus, even when the shadows drew in most closely, and the little candle seemed flickering and smoky, she knew no despair and sustained them all. "It is strange," thought Ish. "She has none of those things on which I used to count so much. Not education, not even high intelligence. She supplies no ideas, yet she has a greatness within her, and the final affirmation. Without her in these last few weeks, we would have despaired and lost hold of life and gone under." And he felt himself humble beside her. At last, one day, he saw her sitting near him, and on her face was such great weariness as he had never seen on a face before. He was appalled. Then suddenly he was happy, for he knew that she would never have sat there and let her weariness show unless the future was safe. Yet it was such a weariness as he scarcely thought could exist. Suddenly he knew that behind such weariness must also lie great grief. At that moment, too, he realized that he himself was now on the road to convalescence, probably less weary than she, able to share the load. He looked at her and smiled.
and even in her weariness, she smiled back.
Tell me, he said gently. She hesitated,
and he was thinking wildly, Walt.
No, Walt was not sick. He brought me a glass of water today.
Jack?
No, I am sure that I have heard his voice. He was very strong.
Josie, would it be? Or Mary?
It might be more than one.
Share it with me, he said to her. I am well enough now.
And still he was thinking wildly, it must not be that one.
He was not strong, but the weakest often endure illness the best.
No, not he.
Five. Up and down the street. Five are dead.
Which ones?
He said, bracing himself. They are all children.
What?
About ours. He said, knowing that she was sheltering him still.
His fear suddenly dominating.
Yes. 5 days ago.
She said.
Then he saw her lips start to form the word, and he knew, even before he heard the sounds.
Joey. What is the good of anything? So he thought and asked nothing more.
The chosen one. The rest might have followed. He only could carry the light. The child of the promise. Then he closed his eyes and lay still.
Chapter 9. The weeks of his convalescence dragged along. Very slowly, his physical strength came back to him. Yet, even behind his physical strength, his mental vigor lagged. Looking in a mirror, he saw his hair now showing streaks of gray. Am I old already? He thought. No, not really old. At least he knew that in some ways he would never be the same. Some fine youthful courage and confidence had faded. Always he'd prided himself on being able to think honestly, to face intellectually whatever must be faced. Now he found his mind swerving off when his thoughts drew near to certain subjects. Well, he was still weak. After a while, he would go ahead once more. Sometimes, and this frightened him, he found himself refusing to admit the actuality, making plans as if Joey were still there, escaping into the happiness of fantasy. He realized that he had always had something of this tendency. At times, it had been an advantage, as when it had enabled him to readjust imaginatively when he had first been left alone. But now he was escaping because the reality seemed too bleak to be faced. Repeatedly, a line of poetry from the wide reading of all those years came into his head when he tried to breast reality. Never glad, confident morning again. No, never again. Joey was gone, and Charlie's shadow lay over them, and the all-necessary state had arisen with death in its hands. And everything that he had tried to do so hopefully in that glad morning had failed. He questioned why. Then often in mere despair, he fled into fantasy. When he could think more calmly, the irony of all things impressed him more and more. What you were preparing against, that never happened. All the best-laid plans could not prevent the disaster against which no plans had been laid. Most of the time he had to be alone. Some of the others still needed care, and what strength remained in M had to be devoted to them. He would have liked to talk to Ezra, but Ezra, too, was not yet out of bed. Except for M and Ezra, now that Joey was gone, there was no one to whom his heart really went out. One afternoon, he awoke from a nap and saw M sitting near his bed. With only half-opened eyes, he looked at her. She had not yet noticed that he was awake. She was still weary-looking, but no longer with the terrible weariness that he had seen before. There was grief, too, but a calm covered it. There was no despair. As for fear, he no longer even thought of searching for that. She looked at him and noticed his opened eyes and smiled quickly. Suddenly he knew that this was the time when he must face it.
I must talk with you, he said, though his voice was scarcely more than a whisper, as if he were still asleep. Then he paused. Yes, she said quietly. I am here. Go on. I'm here. I must talk with you. He repeated, still afraid really to begin. He felt himself humble before her, the child who must ask questions of the grown-up, the frightened child trying to drive fear away and renew confidence. Yet, not being really a child, he feared that even she could make no answer that would bring that security. I want to ask you some questions, he went on. How is it? He began bravely and then paused again. She only smiled at him, realizing his weakness, but she did not tell him to wait till another time. This is it, he said desperately. Is this the way of it? I know what George is thinking, and the others perhaps too. I heard something, even through my fever. Is it a punishment? Then he looked at her, and for the first time in all those terrible weeks, he saw in her face something which was fear, or might be. Even I have failed her, he thought in panic. Yet he knew that now he must go on, or else a wall of doubt and dishonesty would arise between them forever. So he blurted on. You know what I mean. Is it because we killed Charlie? Did God strike back at us? An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Is this why Joey died? Did what it was, he used the disease that Charlie was carrying so that we should all be sure how it was meant? Then as he paused, he saw that her face was contorted with horror. No, no, she cried. Not you two. I faced the others so often alone when you were sick. I knew no arguments, but I knew that it could not be so. I could give them no arguments. All I could give them was my courage. She paused, as if the sudden vehemence had exhausted her. Yes, she went on. I felt courage flow out from me like blood. It flowed out to them all, and I grew weaker as it flowed. And I wondered, will there be enough? Will there be enough? And you were talking of Charlie through your fever. She was silent again, but he could say nothing. Oh, she cried, do not ask me for more courage. I do not know the arguments. I never went to college. All I know is that we did what we thought best. If there is a God who made us and we did wrong before his eyes, as George says, at least we did wrong only because we were as God made us. And I do not think that he should set traps. Oh, you should know better than George. Let us not bring all that back into the world again. The angry God, the mean God, the one who does not tell us the rules of the game and then strikes us when we break them. Let us not bring him back. Not you too. Then she stopped, and he saw that her face was between her hands, so that he could not tell whether or not there was fear in it. But he knew that she was crying. And again he felt small and very humble before her. Once more, she had not failed him. But most of all he felt calm and peaceful and reassured. Yes, he should have known. He, among them all, should not have doubted. Reaching out, he took one of her hands. Do not be afraid. He found himself saying, though for him to be saying so to her was ironic, you are right, you are right. I shall not think such things again. I know the arguments. But when there is death and a man has been very sick, he is weak. Yes, you must remember, I am still not quite myself. Then suddenly she was kissing him through warm tears and had gone from the room. Again he knew she was strong. Again courage could flow outward from her. Oh, mother of nations. He also, as he lay there still weak, he also felt courage again.
whether he had drawn it from her store or whether her words had merely caused him to build up his own. Yes, he thought, and did not flee from the thought. Yes, Joey is gone. Joey is dead. He will not be back. He will not, ever again, come running to see what is happening. Yet there will be a future. Though I am gray-haired now, yet still there is M and the others, and I may even be happy. It will be nothing like the future I planned, now that Joey is dead. Still, I shall do what I can. Again, he felt small and humble. He felt all the great forces of the world at work against him, against the only man still alive who could think and plan for the future. He had tried to face them head-on, and they had rolled over him. Yes, they might well have been too much, even if Joey had lived. He must plan more shrewdly now, work more subtly, select smaller and more practical objectives. Be the fox, and not the lion. But first, he must regain physical strength. 2 or 3 weeks more it would take him. Even so, well before the end of the year, he would be able to do something. Immediately he felt his mind turn over and start to work. A good mind. He found himself appraising his own brain, as if it were a trusty instrument or machine. Old, but still functioning smoothly. Yet he was very weak. And before he had done much thinking, he slept again. Perhaps there were too many people, too many old ways of thinking, too many books. Perhaps the ruts of thinking had grown too deep, and the refuse of the past lay too heavy around us, like piles of garbage in old clothes. Why should not the philosopher welcome the wiping out of it all, and a new start, and men playing the game with fresh rules? There would be, perhaps, more gain than loss. During the weeks of the epidemic, the few who remained well had been able to give only hasty burial to those who died. After the convalescents were again on their feet, George and Maureen and Molly raised the question of a funeral service. Ish, and M with him, would have been glad to let the situation rest as it was. He realized, however, that the others would be happier if a service should be performed. A service might also be of some practical value, to mark a definite end to this period of emergency and fear and death, and signalize a return to a normal and forward-looking life. Although he dreaded the renewal of grief for Joey that such a service might bring him personally, still he felt that after it, he could move on toward whatever more modest plans for the future he could finally work out. So he made the suggestion that the services should be held, and that on the day following them, all normal activities should be resumed. Although he had not given any special thought to the resumption of school, he found that the others naturally assumed it, and he could only acquiesce. By common consent, Ezra was placed in charge of the services. He chose to hold them very early in the morning. As in any community where artificial light was inadequate, rising with the sun was a habit, and they did not have to get out of bed much earlier than usual to be standing at the little row of mounds before the light was yet full. The sky was clear, but the western slope of the hills was all in shade. Some tall pine trees standing by the graves did not yet cast shadows. The season was too late for wildflowers. But the older children, at Ezra's direction, had cut green pine boughs and covered the mounds. Although there were only 5 graves, this loss represented a major catastrophe. In comparison with the small numbers of the tribe, 5 deaths were more than 100,000 would have been in a city of 1 million people. The survivors were all there. Babies in their mothers' arms, little boys or girls holding their father's hands. Ish stood, feeling the weight of the hammer in his right hand. It dragged him solidly down to the earth. He had started without it, but Josie had reminded him, assuming that he was merely forgetful. The hammer, in the minds of all the younger ones, marked a formal occasion. A few months ago, Ish would not have yielded, and he would have made a point of talking to Josie about superstition. But today he had brought the hammer. Actually, he was forced to admit, he himself was drawing comfort from it. He was humbler now, after all that had happened. If the tribe needed a symbol of strength and unity, if they were happier with the hammer as a rallying point, who was he to enforce rationalism? Perhaps rationalism, like so much else, had only been one of the luxuries which men could afford under civilization. They had now all arranged themselves in an irregular half-circle, facing the graves, each family grouped together. From his position in the center, Ish looked first the one way and then the other. George was wearing a conservative-looking dark gray suit, the very one probably that he used to wear to funerals when he had been a deacon in the old times. Or, if not the same one, its twin. Maureen stood beside him in solid black with a veil. At least while those two lived, the ancient proprieties would survive. But all the others were clothed in the haphazard but comfortable leavings of civilization. The men and boys wore blue jeans and sport shirts, with light windbreaker jackets over the shirts against the early morning chill. A few of the smaller girls were almost indistinguishable from the boys, except for their longer hair. But the women and most of the girls declared their femininity with skirts and lent color by means of red or green or blue shawls or scarves. Ezra was walking forward to the center, getting ready to begin. The light of the sun behind the hill was brighter gold now. The hush was deeper. Ish felt his throat full. He was moved. Even though he felt the ceremony to be meaningless and talk in the presence of death to be almost an impertinence, yet also he felt himself close to something very ancient in humanity, perhaps something also very significant for the future. Suddenly he was imagining himself an anthropologist of thousands of years in the future, one who was investigating the life of people just subsequent to the great disaster. Little is known of their culture, he would write. From the discovery of certain graves, however, it is known that they practiced inhumation. When Ezra began to talk, Ish became a little fearful. There were many things that might be said wrong on the occasion. But as soon as Ezra was well started, Ish knew that he should have had more trust. Ezra had not looked up old funeral services. He did not mouth traditional words. He did not speak of a hope beyond the grave. Of all who stood there, only George and Maureen and perhaps Molly would have found comfort in such words. You found it hard to think of such a thing when across the tradition of the past lay the broad black mark of the great disaster. So Ezra, who knew people, talked a little of each of the children. He told some small pleasing story of each of them, something which he remembered and which the others might like to remember. Last of all, he began to talk of Joey, and Ish felt himself suddenly weak. But Ezra did not talk of any remarkable thing that Joey had done and did not even mention that a year had been named for him. Instead, he began to tell of some little incident of play, as with the others. As Ezra talked of Joey, Ish saw some of the children begin to cast quick sidelong glances at him. They knew the special bond that had connected Joey and his father. Were they wondering whether he, Ish, would step forward at the last moment? He, the old one, the American, who knew all that strange knowledge? Would he step forward at the last moment and hold his hammer before him stiffly and declare that Joey was not gone, that Joey still lived, that Joey would come back to them? Would the earth of that little mound begin to stir? But Ish noticed only their quick glances, sidelong and furtive. They said nothing. And whatever they thought, he knew that he could work no miracle. When Ezra finished talking of Joey, he continued speaking more in general. Why did he not stop? Ish felt something wrong. This service should not drag on. Then abruptly, Ezra brought himself to a close. And at the same moment, Ish became conscious of another change. All the world was suddenly brighter.
The first edge of the sun had risen above the ridgeline. Ish suddenly did not know whether to be pleased or dismayed. Well planned, he thought. But a stage trick. Then, looking around, he saw that the others were happy. He, too, relaxed. And even though he recognized the theatrical touch, he was comforted. The return of the sun. That age-old symbol. Ezra had been too honest to promise immortality. But he had chosen his timing and had the luck of a clear morning. Whether you thought of personal resurrection or merely of the continuance of the race, the symbol was there. Now the lanes of yellow sunlight stretched out between the long shadows of the tall, dark trees. In this also we are men, that we think of the dead. Once it was not so, and when one of us died, he lay where he lay by the cave mouth, and we ran in and out there, not standing quite upright as we ran. Now we stand upright, and now also we think of the dead. So, when the comrade lies there, we do not let him lie where he died, and we do not take him by the legs carelessly and drag him into the forest for the foxes and wood rats to gnaw on. We do not cast him into the river carelessly for the stream to float him away. No, but rather we lay him where the ground is hollowed out a little, and there cover him with leaves and branches. So he shall return to the earth, whence all things came. Or else we lay him to rest among the tree branches and give him to the air. Then if the blackbirds come streaming from far to pluck at him, that too is right, for they are the creatures of the air. Or else we give him to the bright and hot cleanliness of fire. Then we go about our life as before, and soon we forget, like the beasts. But this at least we have done. And when we shall no longer do it, then we shall no longer be men. After the ceremony at the graves was over, they all walked back to the houses through the early sunshine. Ish began to wish that he could be alone. He did not feel it right, however, to leave Em at this time. Before long, she must have sensed how he was feeling, and she took the initiative. Go on, she said. It will be better for you to take a walk and be by yourself for a while. He decided to go. As he had feared, the funeral service had stirred him deeply. Some people sought company in time of grief, but he was one who rather should be alone. He did not worry about Em, she was stronger than he. He took no lunch with him because he did not feel hungry. In any case, he could always step into a store and pick out some cans. He did not strap his pistol belt around him, though it was routine not to go far from the houses without some kind of weapon. At the last moment, however, he hesitated uncertainly and then took the hammer from the mantelpiece. The very fact that he took it troubled him a little. Why was it coming to loom so large in his thoughts? It was by no means his oldest possession, because scattered throughout the house were things which he had owned and could remember, even from the time of his small boyhood. But still none of them was like the hammer. Perhaps it was because he associated it particularly with his survival in the first days. And yet, he did not believe what the children seemed to believe about the hammer. He walked away from the house, not caring in what direction he wandered, so long as he could be by himself. The hammer dangling from one hand was a nuisance. He began to feel an irritation against it. Was it really coming to be a superstition in his mind, too, as it was in the minds of the children? Well, why did he not simply lay the hammer down and pick it up on his way home, or pick it up tomorrow? Yet, he did not lay it down. He realized that not merely the temporary inconvenience of the hammer was irritating him against it, but rather his feeling that it was coming to be a fixation with him. He made a sudden resolve to be done with it. He would not let his mind be imposed upon. As he had once before imagined himself doing, he would walk down to the bay and out on the old wharf. Then he would throw the hammer violently, far out into the waves. It would sink through them deep into the soft mud beneath, and that would be the end.
He walked on. Then the memory of Joey flooded over him again, and as he walked, he thought no more of the hammer. After a while, he came out of his sorrow and realized that he was actually walking and carrying the hammer. Then he knew that he was not heading toward the bay, in spite of his decision. He was walking south, not west. It would be a long walk to the bay, and I am still not strong. He said to himself, there is no use walking so far just to get rid of this old hammer. I can throw it into any gully among the bushes, and I shall soon forget where I threw it. Then he knew again that his mind was trying to deceive him, and that even if he threw the hammer into a gully, he would not forget where he had thrown it, and would not lose it in that way. He quit his pretense, for he knew that he did not want to be separated from the hammer, and that it had come to mean a great deal to him in some strange way. At the same time, he realized why he was walking south, and where subconsciously his mind was already directing his feet. He was following the broad street which led to the university campus. He had not been there for a long time. As he walked, his sorrow was still with him, but in some way now it had ceased to be so overwhelming, as if his decision about the hammer had made some change. Now, as so often before, he looked around him, and the mere pageant of the years seized his interest and took his mind away from his grief. This particular section had suffered badly in the earthquake. There was a gully all the way across the old concrete pavement. Some crack of the earthquake had made the break. Rain and running water had widened and deepened it, and now trees and bushes were standing up from the line of the gully, all the way across the wide street. Swinging the hammer to give him momentum, he jumped the 4-foot gap from one edge of the pavement to the other, and was pleased that his legs, in spite of his illness, were not too weak. As he walked along, he saw the houses on both sides of the street, fallen into ruin now, what with the earthquake and the mere passage of time. Vines climbed high upon them. Encroaching trees had thrown porches out of line. Everywhere he observed the struggle between the native plants which were moving back into the gardens and the exotics which once had been planted there and carefully tended. He looked closely at these overgrown gardens, thus to take his mind off worse things. He tried to discover what plants were no longer in existence. He saw no wisteria or camellia or coprosma, though they had once been common. But the tall climbing rose vines were still vigorous. A large and handsome evergreen tree he recognized as a deodar, native to the Himalayas. It was still growing vigorously, but looking beneath it, he found no seedlings. Apparently, it could live there, but would not reproduce. On the other hand, beneath the eucalyptus tree, a species native to Australia, he found seedlings which had sprouted up through the litter of leaves in which nothing else would grow. Coming to the campus, he passed first through a grove of Italian stone pines. Here, everything looked less confused than it had in the gardens along the street, because the pines had spread and formed a canopy beneath which little grass grew. The effect was still park-like. Near one of the trees, he saw a large rattlesnake lying in the sunshine. It seemed torpid, not yet quite revived from the chill of the night. He could easily kill it. He hesitated a moment, but went on. No, he had once been bitten and still remembered something of that horror. But he held no enmity to the whole tribe of rattlesnakes. In fact, that bite had possibly saved his life. Perhaps, rather than being hostile, he should be grateful and form a rattlesnake clan around that totem. No, not that either. He would be neutral. Then he realized that this attitude of his applied to more than just rattlesnakes. He had noticed it in the younger people also. In the times of civilization, men had really felt themselves as the masters of creation. Everything had been good or bad in relation to man. So you killed rattlesnakes. But now nature had become so overwhelming that any attempt at its control was merely outside anyone's circle of thought. You lived as part of it, not as its dominating power. To bother with killing one rattlesnake was foolish because you had no chance of exterminating them or even of appreciably changing their number. If one of them came near the houses, you killed it, of course, to protect the children. But you did not go crusading against rattlesnakes any more than you did against mountain lions. He passed on, went down an almost overgrown stone stairway, and crossed a wooden bridge. He felt it shaky with rot beneath his feet. It had been an old bridge, he remembered, even when he was a boy. Along the stream, the thicket was dense, and he had to push his way through, although underfoot he felt that he was still on an asphalt walk. He heard a rustle somewhere in the thicket, and for a moment was nervous to be without a weapon. It might be a mountain lion. Wolves or wild dogs also were likely to haunt these thickety stream courses. But as he burst through into the open again, he saw only some deer loping off through the trees. High on his left now rose up one of the university buildings. He could not remember what department had been housed there. The shrubbery, which once had been kept neatly trimmed, had now grown up high and shaggy, masking the lower windows. He went on toward his goal. It was only a little way ahead now. He burst through another thicket and saw the great library building. He looked. This building also was half-masked by the shrubbery. One window was broken, apparently because the branch of a pine tree had grown out across it, and then slapped back and forth in some high wind. That accident had happened since he had last been here, several years back. He kept the university library as a reserve for the future. He had even taught the children to respect it. Yes, he had even, he was afraid, put a kind of taboo upon it. In fact, not only here but everywhere, he had always tried to impress the children with an almost mystical value of books. Still, he kept the symbol of the burning of the books as one of the worst things that men could do. He circled the library here and there, having difficulty in breaking his way through bushes. Once he had to crawl over the fallen trunk of a pine tree. The building, as far as he could see, was still in sound condition. He came at last to the window which he had broken many years before and then boarded up. With the hammer, he began to knock off a board. He was careful not to break the board so that he could replace it. After all, he realized with pleasure, there had been a rational background for his bringing the hammer along with him. Having knocked off the board, he was able to climb through into the building. Now he recalled the first time that he had gained entrance through the window. He had come when M had told him she was going to have a baby, and he had been hunting for books on obstetrics. All that had seemed a tremendous problem at the time, and yet it had solved itself without difficulty. Why could he never learn to worry less about problems? Problems not infrequently solved themselves. He went on through the hall and found the old door into the stacks. Things were not as clean as they might be. In spite of his precautions, bats had apparently found their way into the building, perhaps through the recently broken window. There was also the litter of some kind of rodent. But the droppings had done no damage to the books. He put out a finger, rubbed the tops of some books, and brought it away dusty. That was natural, and there was not even a very surprising amount of dust. Yes, they were all still there. Well over a million volumes, almost all the accumulated learning of the world, still safe within these four walls. He felt a sudden sense of security and safety and hope. He gloated like a miser. He went down one flight of the little circular stairway and headed toward the part of the library, the geography section, which as a graduate student he had known best. He came to the familiar alcoves, and in spite of all the years, he felt a sense of having come home. Looking at the shelves, he began to spot books which he had read and studied. One in particular caught his attention, a well-worn volume, rebound in red buckram. He stretched out a hand, took it from the shelf, and blew the dust from its top. Looking at his find, he saw the name, Brooks, and the title, Climate Through the Ages. He remembered the book. Opening it, he saw the card and noticed that the last borrower of the book, the date only a month before the great disaster, had been someone named with the unusual name of Isherwood Williams. Only after a few seconds did he realize that he himself was Isherwood Williams. Nobody had called him by his full name for many years. Now he could actually remember that he had been reading this book during his last semester. It was a good book, and interesting, although largely superseded, he curiously found himself remembering, by the later studies of, well, someone with a German name. Zimmer, perhaps. He laid the hammer down, so as to have both hands for the book. Then he went to where light shone in through a dusty window and looked curiously through the pages. Actually, this book was not of the slightest value to human progress. Climatic change was not a practical problem. In any case, this book had been superseded. He could just as well throw it away or tear it to pieces, but he did not. He went back and put it, almost reverently, into its place. He walked away. And then suddenly everything was dust and ashes in his mind again. What would be the use of all these books now? Why worry about one of them? Why worry about all the millions of them? There was no one left now to carry on. Books themselves, mere wood pulp and lampblack, were nothing, without a mind to use them. Sorrowfully he went away. And he was just starting to climb the circular stairway when he realized that something was missing. He no longer had the hammer. He was suddenly frightened and returned rapidly to the alcove from which he had taken the book. He had a great feeling of relief when he saw the hammer still resting where he had laid it on the floor when he wanted both hands for the book. He took it up and retraced his steps. He climbed out through the broken window and automatically started to replace the board. Then he stopped. The great feeling of desolation came over him again. Why replace the board? It would make no difference. No one was left who would come here in the future to read. He paused, swinging the hammer idly. At last, slowly, without enthusiasm, he picked up the board and, with the hammer, pounded the nails in again. There was no enthusiasm. There was no hope. Yet this was merely part of his life. Just as George would always work at his carpentry, just as Ezra would always be good with people, so he, Ish, would keep some illusion of books and the future. After that, he went around and sat down to rest on the granite steps at the front of the library. Everything was overgrown and half-ruinous. He thought of an old picture which he remembered. Who was it, Caesar? Hannibal. Someone sitting in the ruins of Carthage. He pounded idly with his hammer at the edge of one of the granite steps. It was sheer vandalism. He did not ordinarily do such a thing. The edge of the step chipped off. Still wantonly, he pounded harder. A 3-inch flake loosened and fell. The fresh edge of the broken granite looked out roughly at him. As he sat there, still pounding gently with the hammer, he felt himself for the first time remember Joey without merely dissolving into sorrow. How would it have been anyway? Joey might not have been able to do anything. He was only a bright little boy. He could not have changed things. He could not have stood against all the pressing current of this altered world. He would only have struggled and struggled, and in the end, he would